Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. This week's program will have three readings. A story from the British Broadcasting Corporation about a lost community in the Washington, D.C. area. An essay about writer and playwright James Baldwin and Harlem, New York, from the New York Review of Books magazine. And I'm starting with this article about historically black colleges and universities titled, HBCU Marching Bands Enjoy a Rich Super Bowl Tradition. This appeared in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on February 5th, 2025, and was written by Emmanuel Morgan. Long before Michael Jackson, the Rolling Stones, and Rihanna, there was Freddie Colston. Colston was just a 20-year-old student from tiny Fairbanks, Louisiana, when he traveled to Los Angeles in January 1967. He had grown up in a home without indoor plumbing, but now he was staying in lavish accommodations with about 180 members of the Grambling College Marching Band. Soon, they would step onto the field at Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum to perform in the halftime show of the very first Super Bowl. When we heard that crowd, it was like a spirit got into us and we were walking on a cloud, said Colston, 77, who played the cymbals. Our step was higher and the beat was faster. In the decades before the NFL recruited stars to perform at the Super Bowl halftime show, rapper Kendrick Lamar will headline this year's show in New Orleans, it frequently relied on dynamic marching bands from Grambling and other historically black colleges and universities. With nicknames such as Human Jukebox, Southern University, and Sonic Boom of the South, Jackson State University, the musical groups are known for their creative formations and flamboyant showmanship. And the tradition has endured even as the Super Bowl has morphed into a corporate playground of advertisements, parties, and spectacle. At least 13 Super Bowl halftime shows have included HBCU marching bands, including Usher's collaboration last year with Jackson State, and they are often part of pregame festivities. When Beyoncé performed at halftime of a Christmas Day regular season game on Netflix, she incorporated Texas Southern University. Lamar has not said if he will feature an HBCU band in his nearly 15-minute performance while the Kansas City Chiefs and the Philadelphia Eagles are recuperating, but there will be a presence at the Caesars Superdome when Southern University from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, plays before John Batiste sings the national anthem. Each HBCU marching band has its own style and look, with vibrant uniforms that often match the school colors. But no matter the school, spectators have come to expect a rollicking show with high-stepping choreography, dancers often at the front, and trumpeters and drummers swaying in rhythm while blowing or pounding their instruments. That particular style of performance has always had broad appeal, and marching bands and other musical groups have always been cultural ambassadors for black colleges, said Stephen Lewis, curator of music and performing arts for the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington. Grambling's band of all-black students was invited to Los Angeles at the height of the Civil Rights Movement and to a city still reeling from the flames and mayhem of the Watts riots 2 years earlier. Some black leaders implored university administrators to reject the invitation. There was a feeling early on that it was an empty gesture, Lewis said, of the invitation to Grambling, which is now known as Grambling State University. But that criticism has been going on for quite a long time, and it's something the league still has to work on. After San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick repeatedly knelt during the national anthem in 2016 to protest racial injustice, and a rancorous debate about patriotism and civil rights ensued, some black stars were hesitant to perform at the Super Bowl. In 2019, the NFL began a partnership with Roc Nation, Jay-Z's entertainment and sports company that led to recent performances by The Weeknd, Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, and other prominent black artists. Marching bands carry outsized influence and pride at HBCUs, many of which were founded shortly after the Civil War and incorporated military marching into their curricula. The bands are student recruitment tools, garnering attention at the Rose Parade and presidential inaugurations, including Mississippi Valley State University's performance at President Donald Trump's last month. Some groups compete against one another at events such as the Battle of the Bands, giving energetic flair to contemporary songs. They also caught the attention of football executives looking to infuse entertainment in a new event. When the champions of the NFL and the American Football League met for the first time, the Super Bowl was not yet called the Super Bowl. You looked at those bands, and it was the fact that they were more than just a marching band, said Jim Steig, the NFL's former vice president of special events, who oversaw the Super Bowl for more than two decades beginning in the mid-1970s. They were just performing different than everybody else. After Grambling's longtime president Ralph Waldo Emerson Jones decided that its band would play in the first Super Bowl halftime show, the musicians practiced through the university's holiday break. In the 1960s, Colston said, 5 a.m. practices were not uncommon. They said, "We don't turn down no performances," Colston said. "We're going to go anywhere." One day, Colston said, Jones gave a wad of cash to a drummer with instructions to dole out $2 to each band member for a spending allowance in Los Angeles. When the musicians flowed onto the football field at halftime, Grambling joined the marching band from the University of Arizona, a mostly white school, to depict a map of the United States. The bands played "This Is My Country" for the finale as a sea of balloons ascended. "We had to conduct ourselves in a professional way because this was a group of colored kids in a white society," Colston said. "We were representing our schools, our churches, the towns we came from." HBCU bands were included in the next three Super Bowl halftimes. After the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, the director of the Florida A&M band created a set themed around American pride for Super Bowl III in Miami the next year. George Quillett, a clarinetist for Florida A&M, said many of his bandmates initially disagreed with the concept for the performance, but later changed their minds. "We really got invigorated because our leaders guided us through the process of what we had to do," said Quillett, age 76. The show included them marching into a formation shaped like a flying eagle. After marching into letters resembling USA, the students stood still as speaker blared portions of President John F. Kennedy's inaugural address and King's "I Have a Dream" speech. This season's Super Bowl is the 11th to be held in New Orleans. Southern University took on a Mardi Gras theme at halftime of the city's first Super Bowl in 1970, and Grambling performed a tribute to Duke Ellington in 1975. 3 years later, Southern played a 12-minute pregame routine. Kenny Ricard, a Southern clarinetist who is now 67, said that before taking the field in 1978, the band's members recited the chant they uttered before every performance: "Pick up your feet, drive and blow, start thinking about the show." In those decades, marching bands were eager and dependable entertainment options for the NFL, which was concerned with the logistics of creating a show that could entertain both in-person and television audiences. The starry gate swung open in 1993, when Michael Jackson stood motionless on stage for nearly a minute of raucous applause before singing a medley of his beloved hits with the pageantry of pyrotechnics. Steig said the NFL needed to bolster the halftime show to keep fans engaged and away from counter-programming on other networks. As A-listers took center stage, the past two Super Bowls in New Orleans were headed by U2 and Beyoncé, HBCU bands began taking a more complementary role. In 2007, Florida A&M supported Prince's performance, supplying background music from below an elevated platform. Shelby Chipman, who was then on the band staff and is now its director, said Prince's agent had called the band, asking it to play. His team sent musical information so the band could match the notes he would sing, but otherwise gave it creative liberty for its dance routines and formations. Prince's team visited Florida A&M a few weeks before the Super Bowl to see a rehearsal. The band practiced with Prince only once. less than 24 hours before the game. Normally with these kinds of performances, they gave us the green light, Chipman said. Colston, who has worked in customer service for the NFL's Washington Commanders, still attends homecomings at Grambling State and relives memories of the first Super Bowl. He hopes that the celebrities who now dominate the stage know their history. We open the door for them, he said. That was the article, HBCU Marching Bands Enjoy a Rich Super Bowl Tradition. It was written by Emmanuel Morgan and appeared in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on Wednesday, February 5th, 2025. My next reading is from the British Broadcasting Corporation. The title is Queen City, The Lost Black Community Swallowed Up by the Pentagon. It was published June 19, 2024, and written by Barbara Noel Kennedy. A thriving all-black community flourished just outside Washington, D.C. until its nearly 1,000 residents were forcibly displaced. Now this little-known city is finally being honored. The stout, jug-like building rises 35 feet above the greenery of Arlington, Virginia's Metropolitan Park, a green path-laced oasis set amid Amazon's new HQ2 headquarters. Constructed from 5,000-odd red bricks, the structure feels both industrial and earthy, and stepping inside the small space reveals hundreds of glistening glazed ceramic bulbs cascading from above in waves of blue, green, and brown. This is Queen City, an art installation paying homage to the 903 African American residents of the eponymous all-black community, as well as the surrounding East Arlington neighborhood, who were forcibly removed from their homes in the early 1940s to make way for the construction of the Pentagon. What they did to us was an atrocity, said 93-year-old Dr. William Volin, who remembers his childhood in Queen City before he and his family were kicked out. There was an alleyway with small houses on each side. We had a black fire department, churches, barbershops, all kinds of businesses, he said, recalling how he and his friends used to play and walk to school together. And while there was no running water or electricity common in white neighborhoods at the time, Queen City residents made do in their tight-knit community. It was like one big family, Volin said. 2.5 miles away at the Black Heritage Museum of Arlington, Queen City's little-known story is highlighted through photos and artifacts. According to Dr. Scott Taylor, a third-generation Arlingtonian and the museum's president, the Lost City story starts at Arlington House, the neoclassical mansion established in the early 1800s by George Washington Parke Custis, the step-grandson of Martha Washington who was raised by George and Martha Washington. Enslaved individuals from George Washington's estate, Mount Vernon, built Arlington House before working on the property and in the home. General Robert E. Lee, who in 1831 married Mary Custis, heiress of Arlington House, lived here in the years leading up to the U.S. Civil War. After joining the Confederacy, Lee left, never to return. After many years of focusing on the Custis Lee story, Arlington House recently has been reimagined to encompass the voices of African Americans who lived and labored there, too. After the Emancipation Proclamation of January 1, 1863, freed enslaved people in Confederate states, the federal government established Freedmen's Village on the Arlington House property, which would later become Arlington National Cemetery. The planned community, with clapboard houses, schools, churches, and roads, became a thriving village for formerly enslaved workers. Reformer and writer Frederick Douglass often visited, and abolitionist Sojourner Truth, who lived in the village for a year and a half beginning in 1864, advised villagers on their rights. At that time, Arlington was 75% to 80% black, Taylor said. There was so much black activity then. People were learning to read and write. They were buying property, starting businesses. Joseph Sphinx, an African-American politician born free in Virginia, became a delegate. This scared white people. That's why the federal government closed Freedmen's Village. By 1900, the thriving village had been dismantled, with few home and business owners fairly compensated. Today, little remains other than a historical plaque in Foxcroft Heights Park, overlooking Arlington National Cemetery near its original location. Many former residents left for other black neighborhoods in Arlington or Washington, D.C. In 1892, Mount Olive Baptist Church, which was founded in Freedman's Village, bought 2 acres just down the road and sold lots to ousted congregants. 12 years later, a developer bought 27 more acres. By 1940, more than 200 African-American households lived in this new community, which became known as East Arlington. Queen City was officially a 4.5-acre within East Arlington, though the whole area is often referred to as Queen City. But with World War II looming, the United States required a new military headquarters. The War Department was renting 17 buildings across Washington, D.C., and they needed to consolidate. Federal eyes fell on nearby Arlington, and the fate of the area's African-American community was in jeopardy once again. There was an agricultural farm and a naval base in the area, said Dr. Alfred Taylor, no relation to Dr. Scott Taylor, who was born in Arlington's historically black Green Valley neighborhood in 1934 and has written 3 books about Arlington's black history. Arlington County signed the contract to sell the land in September 1941, kicking off around-the-clock construction. At first, only the Pentagon building went up, and Queen City residents watched in fascination. They were not told until the very last moment, in early February 1942, that they were losing their homes to eminent domain for the construction of roads and parking areas for the Pentagon's 35,000 employees. They were given weeks to find a place to go, said Alfred Taylor. Then they burned their houses to the ground. The real damage is that they broke up homes and families. They had nowhere to go. We were scattered all over the place, Voland said. Many of my buddies I never saw again. Some went to friends and families or they moved north or south. After being contacted by a lawyer hired by residents, First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt secured temporary trailers where some, including Voland's family, lived in the Arlington neighborhoods of Johnson's Hill, today's Arlington View, and Green Valley. The trailer camp was filthy, with a common filthy bathroom where people took showers, he said, remembering how the so-called temporary structures sat on mud flats. It was just awful. We stayed there a couple of years, Voland added. Then they moved us to another trailer camp in Green Valley. And they finally built some new project homes where my family moved. Despite the fact that Voland went on to become a successful educator, he has never forgotten how his family and others were treated. In my research, he said, eminent domain indicates that when they build, they're supposed to enhance an area. But they used eminent domain to destroy an area, the families, the businesses, the hopes and dreams. I deem that as an atrocity. For many Americans, however, Queen City's story remained unknown until recently, when artist Nikisha Durrett created the eponymous installation. She was researching art ideas for Amazon's new headquarters and stumbled upon the Black Heritage Museum of Arlington's display about the vanished community that once stood there. Everyone knows how quickly the Pentagon was built, in record time, she said. It's never mentioned that there were people whose lives were upended in order for this to happen. Durrett said learning the actual number of people affected made her imagine each of those 903 human lives that were forever changed. I wanted to make that number, she said. It's not like an insignificant number. After consulting with historians like Dr. Scott Taylor, whom she called a wealth of knowledge, and meeting descendants of Queen City residents, an idea began to crystallize. She visualized the displaced community as individual vessels, and decided to use pottery as her material. Clay and brick production was a big part of Arlington's history, she said. Arlington was, at one time, the largest producer of bricks in the country. And there were brickyards over there, where many of the African-American men who lived in those communities worked. Voland's father and grandfather, in fact, were among those workers there. Durrett explained that while the artwork is open to interpretation, the brick exterior is meant to evoke a well. There was no running water in Queen City at the time, and young children were charged with getting fresh water from a nearby spring for their families. That lack of resources led me to think of this space that I wanted people to inhabit as a well. And those ceramic vessels would take on shapes of drops of water. Visiting the art installation one June afternoon, I chatted with several groups of people who had previously never heard about Queen City. I love how the installation is continuing to tell the story, said Margot Ehring, an artist and former professor who has been involved in racial justice work for more than 45 years. It's allowing beauty to speak the truth about hard things. Hopefully, it will help people understand how policy affects people. That was the article titled, Queen City, the Lost Black Community Swallowed Up by the Pentagon. It was written by Barbara Noe Kennedy and published June 19, 2024, at the British Broadcasting Corporation's travel website, bbc.com/travel. My next reading, which will take up the rest of the program, is an essay about Harlem, New York, and the writer and playwright James Baldwin from the New York Review of Books magazine. The title is Baldwin's Spell, written by Durrell Pinkney. It was published in the January 16, 2025 edition of the New York Review of Books. Harlem histories tell us that the black churches followed their congregations uptown after World War I. I used to put on a suit on Sundays in order to blend in with worshipers at the Abyssinian Baptist Church on West 138th Street and avoid being sent up to the balcony with the casually dressed white tourist. I'd come for the famous swells of music, for the thump of gospel choirs. But when the music stopped and the pastor began to strut and shout, I found myself wedged into a dark place where the Holy Ghost did not know how to behave. Meanwhile, the oldest black denomination in New York was reported to be having trouble surviving. Dynamism has departed from Mother African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, a Gothic revival structure on West 137th Street. Mother Zion's Harlem home was completed in 1925. Its aging membership has not recovered from the subtractions of the pandemic. The ranks of street vendors and bow ties of the Nation of Islam's newspaper, The Final Call, also seem to have thinned. Harlem has more marijuana shops than storefront churches these days. When black people first started to move uptown, the principal crosstown artery of Harlem was 135th Street. Harlem spread. White people realized too late what was happening and made the best of the deal by overcharging. Overcrowding in New York called for attitudes of transience, poor people working to move on to a better elsewhere, but that didn't happen. The colorblind textbook definition of blight was an area of metropolis that had lost out on the utilities and services sweepstakes. Gilbert Ossofsky's Harlem, The Making of a Ghetto, 1966, is the history of a slum, not a cultural mecca. The jazz age that blasted out of World War I coincided with the Negro Awakening. Harlem became the capital of the Negro world, but that was for a comparatively brief period. Instead, Harlem was, for much longer, the symbol of the Negro's perpetual alienation. As Ralph Ellison said in the essay, Harlem is Nowhere, 1948. Harlem continued to spread, up out of its valley into the West Side's rocky ridges. What made Harlem scary in the decades after the riot of 1964 that left bullet holes in the painted terracotta of the Hotel Teresa was its ghost town aspect, the dread of what might be lurking behind boarded-up facades. Uptown's neglect was not preservation, Sharifa Rhodes Pitts asserted in Harlem is Nowhere, A Journey to the Mecca of Black America, 2011, a haunting work about the district in transition at the beginning of the 21st century. It was as if she had looked up everything about Harlem that she could at the Schoenberg Center for Research in Black Culture at West 135th Street and Lenox Avenue and then gone outside to see how much of its legacy had survived. Buildings in Harlem had decayed and collapsed and ended up as empty lots. Rhodes Pitts came to appreciate them, she said, as places to rest her eyes, as the burial grounds of stories. Then the empty lots got filled in. They acquired building frames. Rhodes Pitts had been looking at the funeral homes and the faded graffiti, the surprising parades and the photography archives at a time when real estate advertisements promised that Harlem's brownstones could be delivered vacant, their occupants shoved off to the kind of low-income garden apartment suburbs that Junot Diaz depicts in his fiction. Nothing stopped the sales, the conversions, the property market, and its mixed-income housing compromises. Goodbye, Lenox Lounge. From Harlem River Drive to Columbia University's new Manhattanville campus beside the Hudson River, construction sites, scaffolds, sheds, and green-painted fences line 125th Street, long since Harlem's principal east-west thoroughfare. Renewal means that even the work of earlier black architects have been torn down to make way for the future. David Ajayi's Studio Museum in Harlem, stacked gray boxes of smoked glass, shoulders its way into being as a glamorous neighbor of the Adam Clayton Powell Jr. State Office Building, an unattractive fortress finished in 1973 that Wikipedia says was designed in the shape of an African mask. Its concrete plaza, African Square, is a site for concerts, fairs, rallies, drumming. Elsewhere on 125th Street, the Liberationist National Black Theater, founded in 1968, has been reinvented as a theater housed inside a 20-story apartment building clad in pink-red brick that, according to its architect's website, refers to the Osun Osogbo Sacred Grove in Nigeria. The future invades by degrees. Tracy Parker's Department Stores in the Black Freedom Movement, Workers, Consumers, and Civil Rights from the 1930s to the 1980s, published in 2019, can explain the Jim Crow history that shaped 125th Street's character as a strip of discount clothing and furniture stores and pawn shops. Some time ago, people suspicious of change frowned on the Whole Foods erected on an empty lot across from the recent Starbucks on 125th Street. Why shouldn't Harlem have what most of Manhattan took for granted? Other people answered. Harlem's rehabilitation was in becoming like everywhere else. Violence has become random, an anywhere, anyplace kind of metropolitan event, and Harlem is no longer perceived as more dangerous than elsewhere in the city. Nobody calls Harlem a ghetto anymore. No one is burning it down for the insurance money, but as thick with impatient traffic as 125th Street is during the day, it is dead at night. LED and neon signs of late-night fast food franchises, mostly chicken, make little impression. The thrill has moved on to downtown Manhattan and Brooklyn. The Apollo Theater still hosts amateur nights 90 years after Ella Fitzgerald won her contest and stepped into stardom, and with the support of the Mellon and Ford Foundations, it is a cultural venue for worthy programs such as a Festival of Arts and Ideas, led by Ta-Nehisi Coates. But hip-hop didn't start anywhere near 125th Street. Harlem hasn't been the center of black culture for a while. Now, Africans are everywhere in Harlem. They have entered the immigrant economy, including the global internet services shops, restaurants, and imported food markets. The delivery guys steadying their phones are African, huge plastic mitts attached to their parked electric bicycles. The women chatting on folding chairs on either side of the bright entrances to hair salons are African. The method of braiding hair is called interlocking. Sometimes escaped strands of braided hair float over the sidewalk. The caftans, boo-boos, and embroidered shirts, the symbols of Wolof, French, and Fonte along 125th Street at the vendor tables of iPhone covers and earbuds, fruit and vegetables, gold chains, and knockoff Nike sweatsuits are reminders that not all black people in Harlem share the same story. Except that the diaspora has come to town. Again. African mosques are the new storefront churches. Periodically, eruptions of beautiful costumes in the streets announce where Harlem is on the festival calendar. The variety of skin tones that Langston Hughes celebrated in his poetry about Harlem in the 1920s had to do with the black America of the one-drop rule. 1/16th of black blood makes a person black. 100 years later, Harlem's variety of people is the result of internationalism. Lowercase populations, black people and white people, white youth unafraid of black people, followed by uppercase groups of sub-Saharan Africans, North Africans, Central Americans, South Americans, and unexplained Asians. And then there are storybook side streets blocked to cars that show off Harlem as the home of young middle-class mixed-race families at play. Black heritage can be child-friendly. Harlem's mix has always been one of class. The unhoused sleep on the floors of ATM lobbies. They sleep on the sidewalks in front of aluminum can and plastic bottle recycling machines. Chinese women of a certain age appear in large numbers with carts at food banks. Tourism in New York City is bigger business than manufacturing. The bargain that development made with the black community holds recognition of Harlem's black history as compensation for its being statistically less and less black day by day. It is the black nationalist past that is the subject of merchandise and creative content, a large part of what Harlem has to sell. Black nationalism once seemed an extreme position, but so many ideas that were on the fringe back then have since moved into the mainstream. A few blocks north of 125th Street, I am in what had been James Baldwin country. His childhood neighborhood of Jewish shop owners is scarcely within living memory. Georgia has the Negro and Harlem has the Jew, he said in the Harlem Ghetto, published in 1948, an essay about, in part, social scapegoats. The delis are now Hispanic or Arab run. Even the urban renewal of the early 1950s that demolished the block between 130th Street and 131st Street where Baldwin grew up is past its sell-by date. The projects that replaced his tenement more than half a century ago look tired, a monument to the folly and the cowardice of good intentions, as he put it in Fifth Avenue Uptown, published in 1960. The playground besides the projects is a memorial to a lost vision of urban policy idealism. The street front of one-story shops that were supposed to cater to those projects has been shuttered for years. Wide, filthy, hostile Fifth Avenue. Baldwin recalled how he and his brothers and sisters pressed their noses against the glass and longed to go across the street to the not-yet-rehabilitated side. Progress takes time, he said in a soft, bitter irony. On August 2, 2024, Baldwin's centenary, an exuberant crowd of mostly women massing in the lobby of the Schomburg waited to take their turn in an exhibition space upstairs. Jimmy, God's Black Revolutionary Mouth, organized by Barry Brown, a curator of manuscripts at the Schomburg, brought together artifacts from Baldwin's life, his work published in junior high and high school yearbooks, handwritten and typed pages from his novels, photographs on interactive screens showing him sitting with a very young Bob Dylan, for instance, jacket covers and books, a Save Our Show handbill for his play Blues for Mr. Charlie. It is an intimate tribute and goes with another display about Baldwin that is on view at the New York Public Library on 42nd Street, Mountain to Fire, curated by Charles Kuykendall Carter. Included in the 42nd Street Library display is a postcard to Beaufort Delaney in which Baldwin communicates his excitement at the opening of his play The Amen Corner in 1954. In the Schomburg exhibition, there is a letter to Lorraine Hansberry written in 1961 pleading for her to put in a good word for him with the theater producer Lloyd Richards, and another to Maya Angelou in 1975 saying that he's been walking up and down scared shitless by his new novel that was also walking up and down making faces at him. Baldwin's letters are held at the Schomburg, some under embargo until 2037, some not. Some, who knows, words of his we've not seen. Baldwin has been well served by his early biographers, David Leeming and James Campbell. The eagerness of the people in front of the 42nd Street and Schomburg display cases looking at what he typed, what he touched, suggested that Baldwin, A Love Story, the forthcoming biography by Nicholas Boggs, is well timed. We want someone to ask and answer again the obvious and the fascinating. What had he been looking for in Harlem, Greenwich Village, Paris, Istanbul, St. Paul de Vence? The Harlem Renaissance was not an influence of Baldwin's youth. even though County Cullen had been his French teacher in junior high school. Similarly, his writings about Harlem make no reference to its cultural past or the jazz age. His father's church was a prison in Harlem, the prison plantation. The classroom and the library were his first escapes. The uptown thug streets and downtown theater proved not to be ways out as a young adult. Baldwin had an epiphany while in New Jersey on his lousy wartime job. If he stayed in the U.S., he would be murdered, meaning that he felt he would be in danger always of having a confrontation with some aggressive white person. It meant he knew he would never be able to hold his tongue. The post-war civil rights movement began with the fed-up black GI generation and the women who had served or done war work in the men's absence, all people who could not be driven back into what had been. For Ellison, to have got to New York from Oklahoma by way of Alabama was enough. Harlem was his left bank, he said. But many black GIs stayed on in Europe. In 1948, the year Truman integrated the U.S. Army, Baldwin got a fellowship and used it to move to Paris. His motives were maybe not different from those of the Harlem Renaissance sojourners in Paris. He did not see the black writer in exile as a tradition. Yet, Baldwin was following in the footsteps of Richard Wright, the most famous black writer of his youth. Wright's wife was Jewish, and they preferred to bring up their children abroad. Because of the Cold War and Wright's radical past, the State Department was sensitive about the interviews he gave concerning the end of colonialism and the racism of U.S. society. He was putting his passport at risk, they told him. Wright died in Paris in 1960. Baldwin wrote of Wright's unhappy last years. Wright's late stories and novels were judged failures. You leave some place and the popular idiom back there can move on without you. Baldwin swore he was not going to end up like Wright. The war lay like a great wall between what had been before and the after he was going to live in. He had the Oedipus complex, not the dictatorship of the proletariat. He wasn't in the position of Wright and Ellison's generation of having to get over disillusionment of leftist politics while fending off the intellectual assault of McCarthyism. Black life may have been existentialist in its essence, but Baldwin hadn't any of Wright's public identification with French philosophy. He was also distant from the great generation of negritude writers then in Paris. Every page of Go Tell It on the Mountain, published in 1953, tells us of the mournful discipline it forced on him. It was sold in religious bookstores alongside C.S. Lewis. Baldwin had come to Paris in the time of the Henry James revival. The structure according to Seasons of Giovanni's Room, published in 1956, shows the influence of James's The Ambassadors. Baldwin's love story about a white American man from San Francisco and an Italian street boy has no black characters. The black novelist Willard Motley had made a sensation with his novel, Knock at Any Door, published in 1947, a retelling of Wright's bestseller, Native Son, published in 1940. Though Motley's young man in Chicago turned criminal is Italian, not black. The movie version in 1951 was also a hit. Zora Neale Hurston and Wright then tried their hands at all-white novels. So here was Baldwin's all-white novel of a youth condemned to death. The notion was that not to have black characters would be freeing. But it was also a commercial hope, how to gain access to the mainstream. Baldwin's lyric voice didn't entirely suit the popular forms he sought success with. Meanwhile, he loved film. That comes through often enough in The Devil Finds Work, published in 1976. Autobiographical writing in the form of remembering the movies he saw as a kid and what they said to him about race. He grew up on film. He studied Leslie Howard. He watched every film with a critic's eye. He wrote about Bergman. He tried to work in film, a dream defeated. There may have been some interior watchfulness on his part. Years later, he spoke of his Paris life as having been more among the Arabs than he'd ever said. The French government had let it be known that public expressions of support for the Algerian Revolution could get black Americans deported. People are just beginning to study what Cold War pressures did to black American writers in Paris. Baldwin said he discovered in Europe that he had been preparing himself for America. To be away allowed him to reflect on where he'd come from. His inner call to act as a witness stirred his transatlantic restlessness. His freedom came with responsibilities. He glimpsed the troubled faces of Albert Camus in a cafe. He went the way of Wright, after all, who was called upon to be a spokesman in the 1940s, the age of radio. Baldwin became a witness in the age of television. He appeared on talk shows in the 1960s to discuss the strife that the American public was seeing on the evening news. Writers back then were national figures. Their opinions were considered newsworthy. Baldwin on camera sounded like Baldwin on the page. His rebuke of American society in The Fire Next Time, published in 1963, carried the shock of the exposé. Ishmael Reed in the excerpt from the film The Price of the Ticket that plays on a loop at the Schoenberg exhibition explains that Letter from a Region of My Mind, Baldwin's New Yorker essay that formed the major portion of The Fire Next Time, was addressed to a middle-class white audience for which his views on racial oppression were new. The faces of the students in footage of the debate between Baldwin and William F. Buckley at the Cambridge Union in 1965 say that they were hearing a language about race and consciousness they hadn't before. This was the spell of Baldwin, the witness armed with thought. In American Oracle, The Civil War and the Civil Rights Era, published in 2011, makes the point that Baldwin came to prominence at a critical moment in American history, the years of the Civil War centennial. Into the celebrations, romance, and reconciliation, Baldwin brought his voice of dissent. The Civil War memorials and the civil rights demonstrations seemed to be taking place in different countries, Blight notes, making Baldwin's also a voice of meditation. Blight observes that Baldwin was not a spokesman for Negro history, that professional historians had been writing for decades the largely unknown story of black people shaping American history, but with little impact. However, black people were very aware of the historical background. The contemporary struggle was in itself a legacy of the Civil War, part of an ongoing historical process which could feel like a revolution. It would take some time for the books that black people read at home to get on the curriculum of what white students read in school. Much of what they would read hadn't been lost or forgotten so much as suppressed. But then it was a tradition of black intellectual life in America that every generation finds it necessary to reassess what is going on with black people. Baldwin's black readers knew, as he did, the significance of Wright's stories, novels, and Black Boy, published in 1945, his searing autobiography. Baldwin said he loathed being asked if he thought progress had been made on the race problem. Harold Cruz, in The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, published in 1967, one of the first black intellectual histories, attacked Baldwin for not offering sociological or economic solutions while calling for a radical reconstruction of American society. Baldwin's emotional appeals to conscience, the literary explorations of the American psychic malaise, becomes a rather superficial literary mode of involvement. Baldwin's assault on liberals was futile rhetorical exercise, he insisted. Cruz blamed both Marxism and Zionism for thwarting the formulation among Negro intellectuals of a radical black nationalist philosophy. Not even Malcolm X, simply reform-minded in the end, was black enough for Cruz. Only one black writer per generation was permitted by the white critical establishment to get anywhere, some muttered. Criticism of Baldwin as an innocent, provincial intellectual who talked of redemption instead of power betrayed some jealousy of his fame. Cruz had wanted to be a playwright. He railed that only when black writers won attention in the mainstream did black audiences become interested in them. In 1965, Mary McCarthy said that, given the U.S. occupation of Santo Domingo, then underway, she was surprised Baldwin would let the U.S. ambassador to London and his wife give a vast supper in his honor. For someone who gave such emphasis to individual experience, to the Socratic premise that the unexamined life was not worth living, Baldwin reveals little directly about himself in his work. It is a central paradox of his essays. The social and personal dissolve into one. The spoken and the written become one. His is a voice we know by his sound, like a singer. Yet he convinces us of its universality as he tells white people that the race problem is actually a white problem. Enough has been made of the influence of the black church in the King James Bible on Baldwin, but his style of reasoning by paradox, clauses falling into rhythmic waves, belongs to him, to his relationship with words, not the word. However, he spoke of having gone into the pulpit as saving himself, of leaving the pulpit in order to save himself, of leaving the U.S. for the same reason. The drive of his argument concerning a turning point in race relations was toward the redemptive possibilities for the nation. But the strength of his argument that racial equality could bring salvation depended on how much people cared about their souls or that of the nation in the first place. Hannah Arendt suspected that Baldwin's philosophy of love would invite hurt. His life divided into before 1968 and after 1968, after the assassinations, after the FBI-led destruction of the Black Panther Party. Because of his speeches, he had from time to time been of interest to the FBI himself. He wasn't an advocate of militant violence so much as an explainer of it, as a response to specific conditions. He, who never had need of ideology, endorsed in the book-length essay No Name in the Street, published in 1972, an indigenous socialism based on the real needs of the American people. This is not a doctrinaire position, no matter how the Panthers may seem to glorify Mao or Che or Fanon. It may perhaps be noted that these men have something to say in this century after all, and may be read with profit, and are not, as public opinion would seem to have it, merely more subtle or more dangerous heroin peddlers. Before 1968, he addressed America as we, and kept in mind shared human frailties. After 1968, his open invitation to all people to discover their humanity was revoked, but his most reckless paragraphs were still animated by the charm and force of the personality in his prose. Eddie S. Glaude, Jr., in Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own, published in 2020, finds in Baldwin's late essays a continuity of purpose, though the civil rights movement had collapsed. For him, Baldwin is a critic of the aftertimes, steadfast in revealing the lie at the heart of the American idea. Glaude reads Baldwin as descended from the Emerson who defied the cruel atmosphere of Jacksonian democracy. We also have to engage in a critical inventory of who we take ourselves to be and to make a decision to choose life. Baldwin's fiction had always been judged by what felt like extra exact standards in those days when Negro parents cautioned their children that they would have to be twice as good as white students just to break even. Baldwin was a committed realist as a novelist, though he decided in his late novels that he was as free as anyone when it came to uses of the first person and rules about point of view. He wrote novels of ideas, discussion novels. His people were desperate to connect. Talk is their medium. Understanding is what they have to offer. Much depends on his ear, on what he gives his characters to say and how they say it. Homosexuality, masculine desire, plays a major part in all his novels, except If Beale Street Could Talk, published in 1974, about a black family struggle not to be destroyed by the justice system. Whereas he dealt with male sexuality in his main subject in only two essays, Giovanni's Room is his one novel in which his sensitivity to the history of women is not in evidence. The narrator of Tell Me How Long the Train's Been Gone, published in 1968, categorizes the word gay as an instance of incomprehensive vernacular. But The Right Human Touch, The Honest Human Touch in Another Country, published in 1962, and Just Above My Head, published in 1979, has healing powers. Baldwin has a bias for butch guys. His novels belong to the big brother figure, the sexualized protector. These days, critics of divergent practices are looking at his fiction for different values and qualities, as In the Break, The Aesthetics of the Black Radical Tradition, published in 2003 by Fred Moten, for instance, demonstrates. He interprets Baldwin's late fiction as visible music, notes that his work is pierced, with screams, songs, prayers, cries and groans, and pursues the meanings of the sound and content of Baldwin's gaze. His gaze may contain the negative weight of our history, Moton says, but it also holds a blessing. God's black revolutionary mouth is a phrase that Mary Baraka used in his eulogy for Baldwin at his funeral in 1987. When he died at the age of 63, Baldwin's reputation in the mainstream was now at low ebb. The rage and militancy of his late works were compared unfavorably to the eloquence and patience of his early essays. There had been a time in the mid-1960s when Baraka baited Baldwin as the darling of the white liberal cocktail circuit. But his presence and that of Toni Morrison and Maya Angelou as speakers at Baldwin's funeral said that black people and black literature had taken him back. Black America had a tradition of reclaiming black stars when they fell from grace in the white world. A recording of Baldwin singing Precious Lord was heard on August 2nd in the Langston Hughes Auditorium at the Schoenberg. The same recording had been played at his funeral. Novella Ford, the Schoenberg's assistant director of public programs and exhibitions, introduced Yaden Israel, a young senior editor at Simon & Schuster and the founder of Literary Swag, and the Chicago activist and rapper Rhymefest for their onstage conversation inaugurating the God's Revolutionary Mouth exhibition. The packed auditorium was ready to be rocked. It was not church, because approbation took the form of row after row of secular jazz finger snapping, but it was spiritual. It was also release day for No More Water, the Gospel of James Baldwin, a recording of music and spoken word by Michelle Ndege Ocello and others. It takes a long time to learn a little, Israel and Rhymefest said Baldwin said. In teaching others, Baldwin allowed himself to be taught. He allowed them to stop pushing themselves for what they didn't know. Israel and Rhymefest said he had taught them that they are the survivors of something, witnesses of something. They said they respected him as someone who advocated for those who were not represented in the spaces where he got to go. They said Baldwin kept Christianity and took away the dogmatism. We can go back as far as Baldwin and still relate to what we're hearing as a living truth, not a historical one. Israel and Rhymefest related strongly to James Baldwin, Nikki Giovanni, a dialogue published in 1973, as a conversation between an elder and a young person. Giovanni was known at the time for some of the most violent, even offensive poems black militancy justified. Baldwin is careful with her, disarming, appeasing. He doesn't want to come off as an old head, but he knows more than she does. He tells her that what has changed the most in America is how black people feel about themselves. The long Schoenberg afternoon said that a new generation was reading Baldwin as a prophet of identity who said, "No one knows precisely how identities are forged, but it is safe to say that identities are not invented. An identity would seem to be arrived at by the way in which the person faces and uses his experience. It is a long, drawn-out, and somewhat bewildering and awkward process." Baldwin came of age in a world after war that believed it could make itself anew. The outcome of the demonstrations, sit-ins, litigation, protests, legislation, and deaths of his prime was far from assured. He walked on sickened and died on his bed of angry moralism. The soulless counter-revolution was going on when they buried him, a winter when some black intellectuals amplified their careers by joining the conspiracy to undermine the civil rights movement. A lesson of Baldwin's story is that education can be made democratic, but the distribution of talent never will be. I asked Baldwin's friend Carol Phillips what Baldwin would have made of the explosion of posthumous attention. Jimmy would love it. He was getting his due. Black people are not supposed to get in the way of another black person getting paid. The summer heat on the street in front of the Schoenberg made me nostalgic. I remember being in a potential mood on my first visit to the new building of the Schoenberg, designed by Max Bond's firm, Bond Ryder Associates, across the street from the hospital at Lenox and 135th Street. One afternoon, I realized that the remains of Langston Hughes were actually in the Zodiac mosaic floor in front of the library's Langston Hughes Auditorium. I thought the auditorium had been named for him, and that was it. But I'd been traipsing over Hughes's grave. In the Schoenberg exhibition dedicated to Baldwin, there was a photograph of Baldwin and Angelou dancing on the very spot. Now, 100 years after Baldwin's birth in Harlem, to have a black mayor of New York City does not feel like a big historical deal. Diversity has been around for decades and is big business. What has happened to the millions of dollars raised in the name of Black Lives Matter does not appear to be a question with much traction. The argument used to be about whether American institutions needed to be torn down or whether they could be changed from within. The charge of systemic racism proved unanswerable as a weapon in committee. Get your absolution here. The bourgeois black nationalism Cruz opposed is victorious. Celebrations of black triumph are not to be deferred. That was the essay, Baldwin's Spell, written by Durrell Pinkney. It was published in the January 16th, 2025 edition of the New York Review of Books. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.